Welcome to the Droma Preventative Health Podcast, hosted by the Jewish Orthodox Women's Medical Association. We provide you with up-to-date information on health topics geared towards the Orthodox Jewish community. This podcast content is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended as medical advice or as a substitute for the medical advice of a physician.
Welcome to the Jewish Orthodox Women's Medical Association, or JOMA, podcast. I'm your host, Elisa Minkin. I'm a general pediatrician and a proud JOMA member, and I'm really honored and really excited to be interviewing another proud JOMA member, Dr. Bracha Tarshish. Hi.
Hi. It's good to be here.
Thank you so much for joining me. Dr. Tarshish is a medical geneticist based in South Florida. She is a 2004 graduate of Sackler School of Medicine. She completed a preliminary year in internal medicine at Maimonides Medical Center in 2005 and then completed a residency in obstetrics and gynecology at North Shore University Hospital in 2009. After working in OBGYN for a short time, she then completed a residency in medical genetics at Emory University. She is board certified in clinical genetics and genomics. After practicing full-time as a faculty member at the University of Miami for a few years, she began working as a medical director for the laboratory division of Evicor Healthcare. In addition to working for Evicor, she also works part-time as a clinical geneticist for Nicholas Children's Hospital. Dr. Tarshish lives in Miami Beach with her husband and three children. In addition to working in industry and at Nicholas, she works as a clinical instructor at Nova Southeastern University in the Physician Assistant Training Program. She has published articles in peer-reviewed journals in the field of medical genetics. So, wow, that's really impressive, and I'm really glad that you're here to discuss this really important topic with us.
Yeah, it's, I would love to clear up some misconceptions, and what I love to do with families, with people in the community, is sort of take away the fear and uncertainty. I think once something is explained well, people become less afraid, and I think genetics is very incomprehensible to a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where the fear comes from. And I also think sometimes there is a fear of knowledge and, you know, mm-hmm. how it'll affect how people think of themselves and how people possibly affect how people think of others in the community. And I would really love to help clear that up and help people just be less afraid to get information.
Yes. And I think in the firm world is also, of course, the fear of shidduchim, and they think genetics means, you know, it'll be passed on, and not all genetic disorders are that way, number one, right? And now we have so much more knowledge to prevent it occurring once you know that you have a tendency to it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Right. It's knowledge is power.
Exactly.
Answers. We're not trying to, it's not a question of saying that, you know, this family has bad genes or anything like that. And it's not a question of saying that the Jewish community has, a lot of mutations or anything like that, or increased risks. It's just sort of knowing what the risks are. Every ethnic group has increased risk for specific disorders. And then it's also some genetic disorders really aren't passed on. Methylation disorders, for instance, generally aren't. Other ones, usually when it happens to a person, you know, for whatever reason, a lot of them are not passed on. Some are multifactorial, but it's just good to know what's going on and to help clarify exactly what the recurrence risk is.
Wait, I want to point out before I forget that I already did a podcast with someone from JScreen, and that is actually called Knowledge is Power. So we're not going to go into as much detail about screening before marriage for, you know, the Ashkenazic mutations and associated disorders. JScreen actually has a very broad panel, and we're not going to talk about the difference between JScreen and Dor Yesharim. You know, when you get tested and you know, you get told about the results, and when you do not. We're not going to get into those details. So anybody who listens to this and says, oh, but I wanted to know that, please scroll back all the way back in the podcast many, many months to the podcast episode called Knowledge is Power with JScreen. So I want to go back to letting you talk. We have such an explosion in knowledge. There is so much more that we know that I think also, in addition to breaking down barriers, the stigma, just to share with us how much more we know and how that impacts us. So I would like to start, you know, give it a focus by talking about children who have some kind of developmental disability. Like back in the day, we'd say, okay, so, you know, maybe we recognize something or maybe we don't. But now we have a much greater chance of making a specific diagnosis, correct?
Yes, definitely. Just to give you an example, the karyotype is, it's a good solid test. It definitely still has, that's that photograph of chromosomes we all remember from high school, you know, in black and white showing the 23 pairs, two X's and a female, an X and a Y and a male, and with their banding patterns. So that was a good test, let's say, for prenatal genetics, for certain, for confirming, let's say, a diagnosis of Down syndrome, Turner syndrome, et cetera, Klinefelter. For unexplained developmental disabilities, the yield for a karyotype was about 3 to 5%. And until relatively recently, in the 2000s, that was all we had. It was close to 2010 where that we developed another test became feasible and economically possible. And that really increased diagnostic yield significantly. And that's the chromosomal microarray. And the chromosomal microarray, it's a different technology from, the karyotype, but it's basically taking a zoomed in view of the chromosome. So you could tell if a tiny part of a chromosome is missing or extra, even to the point of one gene or a portion or a coding portion or exon of the gene. And that's actually increased the yield if you have a child or a patient with unexplained intellectual disability, autism, or just multiple birth defects, multiple congenital anomalies. The yield just from the chromosomal microarray is about 10 to 20%, whereas the karyotype alone was 3 to 5%. So in around 2010, even though it was still a relatively new test, there was a consortium and a consensus put out by multiple geneticists that this should be first tier testing when there's unexplained developmental delay and multiple congenital anomalies, et cetera, that or autism, that plus fragile X testing for both boys and girls if there's a concern for development.
Wait, so children who have unexplained developmental delay, all of them should get genetic testing?
If the family is interested in trying to find out why, then we never force genetic testing. But yeah, if a child has unexplained, it depends on the extent of the developmental delay. The normal IQ is 85 to 115. If it's somewhere around the border of that, not necessarily unless there are other concerns, but certainly if there's autism, a diagnosis of autism, intellectual disability, which is an IQ of 70 or below, that's in the mild range. Or just multiple birth defects that are unexplained with multiple systems involved, even in a child with normal development, then the recommendation would be for them to have those tests.
Right. I mean, I understand with multiple disabilities that, you know, as a pediatrician would be, you know, as we say, a no-brainer. But I don't think we're testing routinely children who have, you know, mild developmental delays, even with autism. Autism is super common. It's like, you know, 1 out of 50 or 1 out of 44 children has it now. That would be a huge amount of children to test.
Yeah, but that actually is the recommendation that children with autism or unexplained, I mean, developmental delay, you sort of have to quantify it. Is it a, you know, is it an early delay or a disability? Is it a speech delay or is it global?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, if it's significant or if it's either suspected to eventually be defined as a disability because past a certain age, it's not a delay, it's a disability, then it actually is the recommendation. An interesting point you bring up about autism is people ask me all the time why it's diagnosed more and more. And there's a lot about that that's difficult to tease out. But if you just want to, one cause for the increased diagnosis is, I mean, first of all, geographically, kids that, are in, better served areas medically, tend to be diagnosed more. There tends to be a higher rate just because these kids are seeing doctors and neurologists. Who are able to diagnose them. But another issue is that autism, whether it's classic autism, especially with classic autism, very often there's an intellectual disability component as well. And what used to be diagnosed more as intellectual disability, classic autism, you know, that was sort of obvious to people and they would diagnose it. But what used to be called intellectual disability eventually became intellectual disability with autistic features and then is now more likely to be diagnosed as autism.
Right. I mean, there's diagnostic reclassification. There's also the concept of the spectrum, right? I mean, this happened with my own daughter. She didn't meet, you know, classic autism or Asperger's syndrome. And when there was a, you know, a broader definition, she fit in. So she was one of those adding to those numbers, right?
Yes. And that's why sometimes we'll get, even though the definition of autism is there has to be some delays or some concerns for delays before the age of three, very often these kids are not diagnosed until later, you know, later in childhood, sometimes even in adulthood, is on the spectrum. And the spectrum is broader, you know, than it was decades ago. So right. It's included.
Yeah. Right. And there's also a reason for a huge increase, when there were specific services. So when ABA became better understood and more available, there was suddenly, you know, an interest in getting the diagnosis. You wouldn't necessarily want a diagnosis if it doesn't help you help your child better. But if it does, right, you know, and that's when my daughter got it, when there were certain services for her that I wanted to get for her, right? It's a label, you know, children are not cereal boxes that you put a label on. A label can be useful to get services, right? To help your child.
Yeah, no, that's definitely the case. As far as I'm concerned, I think it would be nice if kids with intellectual disability had equal amounts of services, right. Equal amounts right. of hours. Right. But yeah, there definitely is a lower threshold to give the diagnosis of autism when there's ABA therapy, which might be 20, 30 plus hours of a week versus if someone has intellectual disability, speech, occupational and physical therapy might end up just combining to like a couple of hours a week,
right.
Especially outside of New York and New Jersey, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Or less. So that's definitely been contributing to that.
I think also it's also understanding, you know, what's going on with your child and also being able to talk to other parents. So I think that there's the reason for, you know, for using that label as well. And that also parallels to understanding what your child's genetic diagnosis is, right? Because people may ask, well, what difference does it make if I have a specific diagnosis or not? You know, I've been told over the years from my daughter, right. Oh, it doesn't really matter. You know, who cares?
Right. So there's a couple of reasons why people might want the exact diagnosis. First of all, a number of diagnoses also go with health concerns, and it's good to know surveillance might be different, and care might be different. You know, for instance, you know, kids with DeGeorge syndrome, they might present with intellectual disability or developmental delay, but they need an echocardiogram. Mm-hmm. Calcium levels done. There is a question. Some of them, you know, they need to have their immunologic system assessed because some of them may not be able to get live vaccines, or they might need, you know, certain modifications. So that's the, you know, that's always very important, you know, just knowing that they might be at increased risk for fractures because of the hypocalcemia. So that's one example, along with knowing what to expect, knowing what some kids are high functioning, and you know, there might be a question of whether they do have children, and just knowing what the recurrence risk is, knowing if the parents are are either unaffected or very subtly affected and could be at risk, at increased risk, up to 50% risk of having another affected child. These are all considerations. Another issue that you touched on is also connecting to other parents. You know, now there's Facebook groups. There's other ways to connect, and parents can help each other. Oh, this is my child at an older age. You have a baby or a toddler, you know, just know what to expect, you know, feel reassured. And then there's also that just knowing certain things work, you know, certain psych medications work, you know, work better, work a little, you know, are less effective, and having other parents and other doctors with and their physicians with specific experience with that specific diagnosis, that is very useful. With epilepsy syndromes, based on the gene that's affected, there's a few genes, but this will dramatically affect the choice for anti-epileptic drugs. So that's one.
I want to get to those two things, you know, screening, genetic testing for psych medications and for epilepsy in a few minutes, because those are actually separate topics, and it's important. I want to go back. I'm still back on the children with, you know, developmental disabilities or, you know, other birth defects or unusual facial features or so on and so forth. So we talked about, those children should be getting testing or can get testing. Does it have to be by a genetic specialist? Can a regular pediatrician order these tests?
So that's a great question. Some pediatricians order them but aren't comfortable interpreting them. You know, sometimes it's a clear diagnosis, and sometimes there's, let's say, a change on the the microarray, and it's a small deletion or duplication, and it's not a well-described syndrome. So how do they? So very often we'll get referrals to from either general peds or even more commonly pediatric neurology for those types of tests. And then the other test that's even newer, within the last decade, it's even become commercially available, is something called whole exome sequencing, and that's actually been a really exciting development. If a chromosomal microarray is looking on the level of chromosomes, like is there a piece of a chromosome missing or extra, whole exome sequencing is doing sequencing of the coding portions or exons. So that's all the exons of all the genes together is referred to as the exome of all 21,000 or so genes that affect health, development, everything. And of those genes, the brain's the most complex organ. So there's a few thousand of these genes that affect development of the brain, maintenance of good function of the brain, etc. So that's actually been an incredible option for families. And there are kids who've had a karyotype in the past. They had a microarray when it became available. They had Fragile X testing. None of this was diagnostic, and they'll be diagnosed on whole exome sequencing.
Right. So what percentage do you go up? Because you said about 10 to 15 on a microarray.
So if someone, those estimates will vary, but just looking at them all together, if someone has not been diagnosed based on other tests, And I also want to include biochemical testing. Sometimes it really is a metabolic disorder that was not detected at birth. We introduced expanded newborn screening in all the states at around 2005, 2006. So kids who were born before that, sometimes they had a metabolic disorder and that affected development. You know, they might have had crises, you know, that were sort of overlooked or they weren't diagnosed properly. And some of them, it really just affected health. I mean, the classic example that we've been testing for over 50 years, basically close to 60 years right now, is PKU, which would cause kids to, if they were undiagnosed and untreated from birth, they'd have intellectual disability, but they wouldn't die from it. So, when that disorder became more well known, doctors went around to institutions of kids with intellectual disability or young adults, and they'd find that a certain, you know, percentage would actually have untreated PKU. And you know, the brain damage is irreversible, but they could have kids who are on diet, now paying better attention, and just behavior was more easy to control. So there are some other less common metabolic disorders that can manifest just with developmental delay. And we actually have diagnosed some kids that way. But whole exome, and then there's also just testing for storage disorders. If there's other lipid storage disorders, et cetera, if there's other features present, like, you know, if there seems to be a regression or a decline with age, if there's stiffening of the joints, if there's kind of progressive hearing loss, if there's coarsening of features. So that was another tool.
Wait. So you're still talking about the newborn screening, which I'm glad you're mentioning it. Cause every baby gets that little, you know, heel pinprick. How many disorders are now diagnosable by that?
I mean, diagnosable, it was standardized about 15 years ago, 15, 16 years ago, to just include, you know, at least a couple dozen metabolic disorders, along with some endocrine disorders like congenital hypothyroidism. That's an older one, and some others. And then there's just other disorders that, it just will affect health more than development, but are still like absolutely vital to find, like cystic fibrosis and the hemoglobinopathies. But more recently, in the last like 4 or 5 years, they've had pilot programs in certain states to test for storage disorders. Some are treatable with enzyme replacement therapies and some are not, so that they can catch those kids at birth. So we're making more and more diagnosis. Even things like Gaucher and Fabry, those are being tested. You know, we've started testing for those along with other storage disorders. So, they're sort of gathering data on that, but that can manifest, let's say, Hunter disease, which is X-linked, but it's a storage disorder. It can manifest as a sort of progressive, kids will seem normal at birth, and then they will sort of lag behind in their development, and then they'll actually lose skills, and there's coarsening of features and other manifestations. They'll develop leaky heart valves and hearing loss. So now we're testing for more and more of those. So those tests for storage disorders, enzyme deficiencies, those were possible if you suspected it based on other manifestations besides developmental delay, or if there was regression. With whole exome sequencing, we can actually look for multiple disorders at once. Checking enzyme levels, you can also just check for the mutation in those actual genes. Both recessive disorders, X-linked disorders, and dominant disorders that you would expect to have a new mutation in the child. So that's actually, if a child has had like the full diagnostic workup up until whole exome sequencing. So they've had microarray. They either had a good newborn screen or those metabolic and tests were performed later. And then you add on whole exome sequencing, it's probably adding at least another 20% diagnostic yield. Wow. For unexplained developmental delay based on that. Some other centers will, kind of estimate that higher, but if someone's had the full workup, this is probably adding another 20%. Whole genome sequencing, which is going to look at the other 98 or 99% of DNA. If exons are the coding portions, introns, and exons are about 1.5%. Introns are the other 99%, which were traditionally thought of as junk DNA, but they're not. Even if they don't code for amino acids, which are the building blocks of proteins, there are all sorts of regulatory sequences, promoter regions within that, within the genome, within introns. It's a more expensive test because it's the other 99% of DNA. But once that becomes more commercially available, more accepted by insurance, that's probably going to increase the diagnostic yield by another 15%. Because if you take human genetic disorders that are diagnosable by doing whole genome sequencing, 85% will be diagnosed just by doing whole exome sequencing, just by sequencing the exons or the coding portions. And the other 15% will be in the other 99% of DNA, but that's still going to significantly increase the diagnostic yield.
How expensive is this testing of the 99%, whatever you called it?
So I'm hoping within a few years it'll be covered by insurance, because whole exome sequencing wasn't. It wasn't covered by commercial insurance, and then it started to be.
Oh, I know. Yeah.
It was not covered at all by Medicaid, and then now it is. Now it very often is where I practice. But whole genome sequencing, if you pay for it out of pocket, it's probably at least $10,000.
Wow.
And there are people, the one or two companies that started out doing it, there were people who were like healthy but had money to spend, and they said, oh, I'll do whole genome sequencing. I'm curious. But as a diagnostic tool, once it's accepted by insurance, then it should be free or to families, or just come with a low copay. So that's probably going to happen in the next few years.
That's amazing. So I want to go back a little bit to the newborn screening. There are specific criteria for what disorders are included. Mm-hmm. Can you explain that? Because I think that's an important point.
So the criteria,
any disorder.
Right. So there has to be an intervention that really helps prognosis. Not that you always get a perfect result, but this will save lives or save kids from disability, and from health crises. There has to be an intervention that's relatively easy to implement. There has to be enzyme replacement therapy, maybe is one thing, for some of the storage disorders, you know, the metabolic disorders, very often it's diet. You know, for PKU, they can't have phenylalanine and they need tyrosine added on. So that was the first one. And that was not simple, but relatively simple compared to the other ones. For some of the others, like maple syrup urine disease, you know, whatever the formula is, they'll just take out the amino acid that the child doesn't have an enzyme to break down. So that's one requirement, that there has to be an intervention that's kind of reasonably, cost effective, not necessarily inexpensive, but, you know, to implement just sort of on a wide scale, and that it's, and that it affects prognosis. It affects, life expectancy, quality of life. You know, it affects the level of disability. It has to be easy and reasonable to test for, which is why, you know, in the beginning we started with PKU. It was a bacterial inhibition assay. This was before we had tandem mass spectroscopy. And, mm-hmm. Yeah. And then we added, once that came onto the scene, we were able to add a number of inborn errors, metabolic disorders based on sort of levels of amino acids, of, you know, of, plasma amino acids, acyl carnitines, that type of thing, just sort of, kind of assessing how the body handled, you know, just certain chemicals that it would take in, or how the body broke down its own fats, or, you know, that type of thing. Is there an enzyme deficiency with that would cause the child to become hypoglycemic? Testing for storage disorders is a lot more recent, and that's because we do have enzyme replacement therapies. We have other ways to intervene and to help prevent disability. So those are slowly added. So those are basically the requirements, that there needs to be relatively inexpensive, and feasible to test on a large scale. There needs to be a real meaningful intervention, and just that it can just be implemented sort of nationwide. States used to sort of choose and upgrade their own programs for genetic screening, for newborn screening, in terms of what was done. But you basically had a situation in the early 2000s where states like New York and California were testing for dozens of disorders, mm-hmm. and not to put down Mississippi, but Mississippi was testing for three. They were testing for PKU, leukemia, and congenital hypothyroidism. And they didn't even implement PKU testing till 1985, whereas the other ones, most states had it in 1965. So like this, you know, sort of kind of universalizing this, at least throughout the United States, has been a good program that saved a lot of kids. And now it's like there's a central, every state, generally in the state capital, has state labs. The newborn screening, you know, the card is supposed to be collected from the child between 24 and 48 hours of life. It should be dried in a certain way, sent promptly to the state lab in the capital. And then the newborn screening nurses are supposed to call up criticals or just abnormal screens within hours of getting the abnormal results. Ideally, we should have kids at least an alert come out by about a week of age. It doesn't always happen, but ideally that's what should happen. And then there should be good communication between the hospital, should be able, or the pediatrician should always be able to reach the child's parents.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I find the way it works is no news is good news when it's normal and you don't hear back until you get a report, like from the state at about 2 weeks old, that it's negative. But something abnormal gets communicated very quickly.
That's the way it should be. I mean, sometimes what the breakdown in communication is that if there isn't a good sample, sometimes like that should be repeated right away.
Right. You know, we get that all the time. I mean, pediatricians spend a certain part of our days trying to get, you know, them done properly. And then of course the other big issue is just because you get a call that it's abnormal doesn't mean it's a real problem. And that's what I think pediatricians spend most of our time dealing with when it comes to the newborn screens, is doing repeats for, you know, various of the subtests that are not actually a problem. So people should not panic when they get a call back about their newborn screen. And then I'm seeing this for thyroid, for cystic fibrosis. A lot of the times it just has to be repeated. It was done too soon. It was a premature baby. You know, there's a lot of categories where it ends up not being a problem, repeated, and it's fine.
Right. And TPN, for instance, can cause multiple abnormalities. Mm-hmm. It looks like multiple amino acid acidopathies because a lot of the metabolites will be elevated, especially when there's immature liver, that type of thing.
Right.
I mean, when we admit right away, it's if we expect, let's say, propionic acidemia, and it really is like sort of a classic pattern. If it looks like maple syrup urine disease, certainly if it clearly looks like PKU, we want to see them at least in our clinic as soon as possible. So, you know, definitely, you know, it's very helpful to speak to the geneticist in your area to be like, how much should I panic? For instance, I've practiced in Georgia and in Florida, and it's very, very hot in the summer. And that gives us like this sort of artifact that looks like galactosemia because the enzyme breaks down on the cart in transit to the lab.
Oh, wow.
Call it summer galactosemia. And so if it's borderline and like, you know, it's from a hospital that we know doesn't send right away or doesn't send efficiently and it's far from the capital, you know, we'll call, but you know, we won't be in absolute panic mode. There's a certain art to it that you sort of pick up after, you know, after some time, and it actually is region dependent.
What I'm thinking in my mind as I'm asking you these questions is I think there is a balance between getting good information and getting possibly either too much information or information that doesn't necessarily help you. So I want to know what we know so far about epilepsy and psych meds. I have to say, full disclosure, I've done them both for my daughter and they weren't helpful. So maybe for others it is. It isn't always, is the point that I'm making.
Yeah, I want to just draw a distinction between them. So testing for someone with epilepsy, especially if it starts at a young age or in infancy and it's intractable, that child should have genetic testing, for instance, because mm-hmm. some genes are very clearly actionable, like SCN1A. There are certain treatments, and also you can make prognostic predictions. There are specific anti-epileptic drugs that are recommended or not recommended for children with mutations in different genes. PALG is another example. So they at least they should have an epilepsy panel. It doesn't have to be 1,000 genes, and those exist, 1,300, 1,500 genes. And some of those are to get answers, but some of them are clearly actionable. So those I would recommend. Neurologists send them all the time. Geneticists send them all the time. And they do affect treatment. And then even if they don't, they can very often give a clear diagnosis. So that affects prognosis, that could affect treatment down the line. There might be some idea what does work, what doesn't work, anti-epileptic medications, the ketogenic diet. And then parents can also interact with other families that have like this clear diagnosis. Genetic testing for psych meds.
Wait. Genetic testing for epilepsy. One second. Before you get there, I just want to make sure I'm clarifying here. You're saying two different things. You're saying it can help for picking the right medication, but it can also help for diagnosing a specific epilepsy disorder. So those are two different things.
Right. But it can do both. It depends on, there are certain genes where it's SCN1A, you know, what was called Dravet syndrome, which, you know, can cause in the severe mutation, can cause this like infantile epilepsy that's very difficult to control. So those PALG, those are a couple of examples of genes that they should really be on every panel, especially with, you know, with a child, especially who has seizures from a young age, especially if they're frequent or difficult to control. And those are very commonly ordered. And then some of the larger panels at least give a diagnosis, kind of like the panels or the genetic testing that we'll do for neurodevelopmental disabilities. Testing for psych medications is not that's not those type of genes. There you're testing the cytochrome type of genes, which sort of is kind of an assessment of how your liver or, you know, how your body sort of metabolizes medications. So it's like, are you an ultra fast metabolizer of this? And based on that, they can make recommendations. Well, this psych med might work a little better. You might need a higher dose of that. I actually have less faith in those than I do in, at least for psych medications, than I do in genetic testing for epilepsy.
Why?
Because there's less of a clear science behind that. It's less supported by studies. And they're actually, this type of genetic testing, actually, we do recommend it for beginning certain medications, but they're typically not medications for depression. They may be medications for Gaucher disease if you're trying to go onto oral medications through Belga, instead of being infusion dependent. They might be medications for, for someone who has Huntington's and there's no treatment for it, but, you know, there might be some medications that can help relieve some of the symptoms. So there are actually clear clear recommendations for that. And that does make sense, and we do recommend it. But testing for like GeneSight or, you know, for depression and anxiety, for trying to treat that medically, there's not a lot of solid studies and science behind those tests, behind actually recommending those tests.
So is there such a thing as too much information? Because like I'm looking at this, okay, epilepsy, psychiatric issues, autism. I mean, this is already adding up to a lot of the population. Mm-hmm. These are common disorders, all of them.
Okay, so, you know, for depression and anxiety are extremely common. Mm-hmm. Sometimes these types of tests are also recommended for, you know, children with ADHD before beginning medications. You know, if you think depression and anxiety, something like 15 to 20%, you know, ADHD, especially in boys, is very common. It's similar percentages. I don't recommend cytochrome types of those types of testing, GeneSight, for psych meds or for ADHD medications. It's not just that there's too much information. It's just not clearly actionable. It's not clear information. And saying, oh, you're a relatively quick metabolizer, you're not, you know, you're not looking for Mendelian disorders. I think if you have a reasonable suspicion of a Mendelian disorder, you know, something that is inherited in a clear fashion and you can make predictions, you can make a diagnosis. If a family is interested in testing for their child with autism, with unexplained intellectual disability, with multiple congenital anomalies, I actually don't really feel that too much information is a bad thing. It depends on what the family wants, because some of it is clear information. It's information that, you know, I could say like there's a mutation in that gene that caused this issue. So there definitely is a distinction between you know, studies where it's you're sort of trying to put together a picture, but you may not get a clear answer.
Right, you're looking for that piece of the puzzle.
Yeah, but versus like just looking for anything that like seems to have a clear inherited component, or even if it's a new mutation in that person, trying to find an answer. I mean, those I basically will do. I'll order testing as far as the family wants.
Right, and I'm going to point out that even if you go through all of the tests you mentioned, all the way through whole exome sequencing, and I'm putting aside whole gene because that is not, you know, available for most people,
right?
Even financially, and it's not covered by insurance. You can enroll your child in a study, which is actually what I did with my daughter. I enrolled her in the Manton Center for Orphan Diseases. You can do that. Mm-hmm. And then as information changes, you know, your child might be studied. The downside to that is that you will not necessarily have access because you're enrolling your child in a study. It's no longer for you. It's for finding information in general.
Yeah, there's different studies. Some are just sort of the natural history of a disorder. Some are, you know, can we find a genetic change that before we could get, when whole exome sequencing was very new, we could enroll kids sometimes as part of a trial. Right. And sometimes, you know, the family would be an answer, but it wouldn't be in this timely fashion. They wouldn't necessarily be given all the genetic information. So, but there's also clinical trials for, you know, kids or adults with a clear diagnosis. And that's a reason they might need genetic testing, you know, to actually confirm it before they can be enrolled in a trial. Or they don't even know what they're affected by, so they need that genetic testing. So that's another point, bringing up clinical trials, that becomes sometimes a possibility because of genetic testing versus a clinical diagnosis.
Right, and the point that I'm making it is because, you know, I remember when people suggest that my daughter get a test, and the test was also like $10,000. I'm like, no. And then it ended up, when it was done, it was negative anyway. So just that people shouldn't feel, oh, well, there's this new test out there, and it's $10,000, but it's 99% of the genes that were left left out of the other test, you know, that they don't feel pressured to do that.
Right. And then it's also just, you know, knowing what the diagnostic yield is. Okay, if 85% of human genetic disease that's going to be found on whole genome sequencing is contained within the exons, and whole exome sequencing is free to a family because it's covered by insurance, then you look at what's highest yield and you look at the right. family's financial situation. Yeah.
Right. And it sounds like it would be higher yield to get the other 99%. But like you said, that is not where most of the money is.
Right.
Genetically exactly. speaking. Yeah. So that's yeah. important. But when I mentioned too much information, you know, I also find that, you know, I had a parent recently that came in with this huge, thick, you know, pile of genetic testing, and it came up with these, you know, single genes for a disorder where you needed to have two, right? Because there's recessive disorders where you need to have two genes for something. They had one gene for something that caused a problem. And they also had what are called variants of concern. We weren't really sure what those do. And so there was a tremendous amount of anxiety, understandably. And that's kind of what I was referring to is, you know, could there be too much information? And how do you interpret it?
Sure. Was this direct to consumer testing or was this?
No. No, it was done by a specialist. I don't want to give further information. I always protect my patients.
Sure. Okay.
100%. So, I'm not going to get into more detailed on that.
I'm glad you're bringing up, first of all, testing that's ordered, you know, if there isn't genetic counseling as a component and it's a large test, and I'm glad you're bringing up variants of uncertain significance. So people tend to think in the, you know, just kind of the lay public that if you do genetic testing, you get one of two answers, you know, yes, we found a disease causing mutation, you know, a disease causing change, and we now have an answer, or no, you know, we found nothing, we didn't find an answer. But there's this question mark third option called a variant of uncertain significance where a specific DNA base is changed or a tiny part of a gene is missing or duplicated at a specific locus, at a specific area of the gene, but we're not sure how to interpret it. And we have, I mean, the labs have, they have tools to try to interpret it. They have things like Polyfen, you know, they have funny names like Polyfen, SIFT, mutation taster is one. And they basically look at a few things. Is this variant, is this change, you know, they don't want to say it's a mutation, which sort of implies that it's pathogenic or disease causing. Is it found in a certain percentage of the population in population databases, which would sort of suggest that it's benign? Is it not? At what percentage? Okay. Has it been, you know, found obviously in affected people? Has it been found in unaffected people? Is it, you know, who maybe were tested for other things. And then what's it predicted to do to the protein? Is it a silent change where the amino acid is the same? Is it, you know, is the amino, so that's, you know, that would be expected to be benign. Is the amino acid different, but it's got a certain, you know, a similar charge? Like, how would this affect the way the protein is created? The amino acids, are being the building blocks for proteins and the way it's likely to fold. And it's whether it's going to be positively, negatively, or neutrally charged. Those are all tools that are at their disposal. And sometimes they'll still call it a variant of uncertain significance, but I'll look at the report. I'll look at all the data, which is something a geneticist can do. I'll sometimes call, you know, the lab genetic counselor, and I'll just have a discussion, and I'll be like, you know, I'll have more of a suspicion that it's likely to be tolerated, meaning it's benign. It's not, you know, even though they're calling it a variant of uncertain significance, or it's, you know, likely to be deleterious or pathogenic. And I will tell some patients sometimes I'm very suspicious that this could be your answer, even though at this point there's not enough information. We also have a database called ClinVar that the labs use and we use as clinicians that will give you all the information that it's sort of curated publicly, and the contributions are made by scientists and by commercial labs, just saying like, this is what we think about this particular variant in this particular gene. Because it'll come up again and again. And as genetic testing becomes more prevalent and cheaper, you'll get more instances of this particular change coming up. But sometimes it really truly is a question mark, even after all the investigations. So you can do, especially if you do a huge panel, especially, you know, especially if they're ordered, you know, by people who aren't as, by specialists who aren't as comfortable. They're not geneticists. They don't have a genetic counselor in their office. The larger the panel, the more likely you are to get variants of uncertain significance or VUSs, even multiple VUSs. And then also when we're testing for recessive disorders, very often we'll get, we'll get either they're, they have one allele affected, they have one copy affected. So they might be a carrier, but this would not be expected to be our answer, you know, unless there's a possibility that there was a mutation on the other side we didn't find. Or it's a change in a recessive disorder, and there's always a question they could be a carrier, and that could be something for them to know later on. So yeah, I mean, the larger the genetic panel, the more complicated it is. But that's not too much information. That's kind of casting a wide net and sort of fishing, and then maybe not being able to fully interpret what might come up. I mean,
Right. I think the importance is to make sure you get the right people to help you interpret, and that, you know, is where a genetic counselor can come in, or a geneticist like you, because some of this stuff is so complex that it might, might be out of the bandwidth of a genetic counselor who has not gone to medical school.
Right. Although, genetic counselors are very good at interpreting variants, but, you know, just being able to do a physical exam in my case and really getting into the history, sometimes there is this added level of kind of being able to make a judgment of what a variant, how suspicious a variant is. Right. Another thing is not just knowing how to interpret, but knowing what to test. Like sometimes people will just test everything, you know, there's a certain judgment to that also. Right. I also I wanted to touch on or we could come to it later, but there are certain disorders that it's either not appropriate to test for, or it's not appropriate to test below the age of 18.
Yeah, we're going to get to that in just a minute. I just want to mention one more thing, which is, I'm not sure this is the right term, vulnerability gene, because this patient also, you know, got them the report that, you know, your child has a increased risk of X, you know, compared to the general population.
Okay, so there is a susceptibility locus, or that's another part of genetics. That's another thing that makes it complicated. So I want to sort of draw a distinction there as well. There is a concept in genetics, and it's pretty common with different disorders, of either variable penetrance or variable expressivity, where variable penetrance, which means it can mean two different family members, let's say a parent and a child, both carry the same single gene mutation, or they both carry the same micro deletion, the same deletion of a chromosome, of a small piece of a chromosome missing or duplicated. And there can be reduced penetrance, meaning some, you know, a parent might not be affected at all and a child might be affected, or there's variable expressivity, people will be affected to different extents. Very often there's both reduced penetrance or incomplete penetrance and variable expressivity. And there's a couple of examples of susceptibility loci. So the 16p12.2 recurrent microdeletion, which recurrent microdeletions tend to sort of, some kids have their own parts of a chromosome missing or extra, and it hasn't been widely reported. But there are certain parts of a chromosome that tend to be duplicated or deleted during the process of meiosis. So it'll come up again and again, not frequently, but maybe one in every 4,000 births, one in every 10 to 20,000 births. So when a small part of the P arm of chromosome 16 is deleted, 16p12.2 recurrent microdeletion, that's a susceptibility locus. It makes people who have it susceptible, you know, maybe based on a second genetic hit that we aren't able to find or quantify, maybe based on environment, maybe based on, you know, interactions of the 20,000 plus genes and environment. But it's susceptible to developmental delay, intellectual disability, seizures, sometimes psych illnesses like schizophrenia and someone with normal intelligence. Another example is the 15q13.3 microdeletion. So very often you'll find it's inherited from an unaffected parent or a very subtly affected parent. And there's single genes that are exactly the same way. So that's still like looking at a Mendelian disorder. And if you order a chromosomal microarray, you can always have that come up, as well as variants that you're not able to interpret. But if you're just looking at a number of different genes and it's not, you know, there's also susceptibility, like, you know, like the direct to consumer testing, you know, you might get an answer, you know, the rest of the population, I'm sort of making up these numbers, has a 20% chance, you know, a 15% chance of developing type 2 diabetes. Yours is 25%. And that's based on genome-wide population studies based on like SNPs or single nucleotide polymorphisms and disease. And we're not looking at clear Mendelian patterns here. So
that's what I was referring to, is something where they say you have a higher chance of getting some disorder that's relatively common in the population. Right. And so that just interactions with genes and environment, right? There's epigenetics. It's complicated.
Right. So I don't necessarily recommend having those types of testing, and they can be ordered, but for a long time, those were available in direct-to-consumer tests because they're not Mendelian disorders in a clear, they're multifactorial disorders, mm-hmm. and they're, you know, and saying like you have a 20% risk versus a 15% risk, that doesn't mean anything.
Scares people, but it scares people.
Right. Another common example is the ApoE kind of group of genotypes, that affect susceptibility to Alzheimer's and early death. So we're not talking about like a PSEN1 mutation that, you know, if someone has a 50% chance of inheriting it from parent, and if they get it, they basically have an extremely high chance, like a lot more than 50% of developing early onset Alzheimer's. I'm talking about the APO, group of genes where, you know, having the worst genotype can increase your risk by 12 times of developing Alzheimer's, but it's not, that's a susceptibility locus. I have very mixed opinions about whether people should be testing for that, because they might make some lifestyle modifications based on that, like sleep more, you know, adopt the MIND diet, you know, which does seem to work, you know, make sure to get plenty of exercise.
But everybody should do that. And you're going to have anxiety.
Right. It really depends on someone's ability to handle it. So yeah, I mean, there are susceptibility loci that, you know, I think are fair game because they really are Mendelian disorders. And then there are other ones where you really get no answers. And then there's that in between case of the Alzheimer's susceptibility where it really depends on the person. You know, some people are sure they want to know and some people don't. And that's an issue also with the direct consumer testing.
Right.
People don't really understand exactly everything they're testing for. And some of the information can be scary.
Right. But it's not even just direct to consumer. You're having neurologists, like you said, or pediatricians order these tests and they get them back and they do not have the expertise to interpret them.
Yeah, I mean, it's my job in industry is sort of taming that beast. It's deciding whether, you know, testing and, you know, most genetic tests these days are not ordered by geneticists, and there are thousands of genetic tests, and it's sort of deciding whether this is indicated. And some of it, it's not just the cost under insurance. Some of it is like, we don't have, you know, it's not clearly actionable. It's not, you know, it's a susceptibility. It's not, you know, a clear answer. And it's also, you know, it's too much testing. Like we look at all of those. Sometimes we look at the genes and like, this is too broad of a panel, even though they're billing with the same genetic code and, you know, the same lab procedure code and the reimbursement's the same. So, you know, I do look at that in my full-time job, you know, trying to sort of curb a little of that.
Right. I mean, you know, just as a doctor, you know, the more tests you order, you'll find something and you won't necessarily know what to do with it.
Exactly.
This is the most basic principle of not ordering, you know, too much tests, to order the right tests. And again, we're not talking about a child with an undiagnosed, you know, disorder that we're still trying to figure out what's wrong with them. We're just talking about all these tests. Let's try to find out more information. More is not always more.
Yeah. I mean, even before, you know, we were talking about DNA and lab tests, you know, just as a pediatrician, there were tests you didn't necessarily order every possible test on a healthy child.
Right. So I did promise you could talk a little bit about some of the other screening tests for future disorders.
Right. Oh, just going back to certain adult onset disorders, did you want to just...
That's what I meant.
Oh, okay. Okay, so certain screening tests for future disorders. So there's a few categories of that are just sort of coming on the horizon. Newborn screening is expanding really exponentially. You know, we started out, again, just testing for PKU. Mm-hmm. We added on congenital hypothyroidism, galactosemia. Now we test for, you know, for disorders of fatty acid fatty acid oxidation, which could lead to severe hypoglycemia, you know, and you can prevent death and disability that way. We test for a whole number of, you know, amino acid abnormalities, other abnormalities that can be treated with diet and just preventing a crisis. We're now testing for storage disorders mm-hmm. because there are treatments for that, with enzyme replacement therapy. More and more, we're adding these types of storage disorders, and more there are treatments, that testing for SMA at birth. Now that there's these things will come up, whereas they weren't part of newborn screening like 5 years ago.
Do you remember the story of the little girl where they were trying to raise $2 million for her? I think she had SMA type 2.
Yeah. And, I'm glad that everything came through for this child. Like,
right, thank God.
Yeah.
Thank God. But I think it does bring up the issue of when you get a diagnosis and there is a medication, but the medication is exorbitant and not covered.
So insurance is what happened. At that time, Spinraza had been approved a few years before, and it was the first treatment for SMA. You know, it was, as a geneticist for a dozen years, this was like, you know, my patients won't die, you know, but it was, it had to be given intrathecally, you know, basically into the cerebral spinal fluid. It had to be this like repeated infusion, and it wasn't as good. We were going to restore some mobility. We were going to, you know, certainly extend lives, and they wouldn't lose their ability to breathe, but it was not as superior. I mean, gene therapy in general is a miracle. Then Zolgensma, Spinraza was approved at the end of 2016. Zolgensma was approved like in May or June of 2019. And that was that summer. So, I mean, there is now that's a life-saving medication. It's not 100% curative. You know, your outcome is better, obviously, if it started right at birth, which touches on newborn screening. But it's really, you know, gene therapy in general is incredible, and it's exorbitant, but the consensus is that insurance needs to cover it.
Right.
And that actually is something I actually have worked on a couple of Zolgensma cases and sort of like in my job in utilization management, and I sort of pushed that through. But in general, that tends to be covered. Not sure exactly what happened in that case. I think in the end, like insurance.
She was very close to her second birthday too, in which case she wouldn't have been eligible.
Right, right. And I think in the end, insurance did come through and people had donated.
It did.
And,
you know, right.
Yeah.
Right. You offered it back, which is very nice. I know I was part of that campaign. So.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And we're giving to that.
Yeah. I mean, that was a case where like it was a brand new medication and insurance did cover, insurance covers it now. So Zolgensma can be approved, especially now, like we're doing it on newborn screening. And, you know, we do know that the earlier it started, it's given the better. And I haven't heard lately that there have been issues. And whenever it's an unusual clinical scenario, like, you know, a preterm baby, in my capacity in utilization management, sometimes I sort of shepherded it through so that people can have it. But I know if the child meets requirements, at least now in 2021, it should be, it's generally given, approved and given in a timely manner.
Right. You know, I don't think I gave you a chance to explain about the adult onset disorders, and I don't know if it's a long thing, because we're really reaching the end. Is this something specific?
Yeah, there's a few things. I know you put in BRCA and Huntington's in the outline. So Huntington's disease is, you know, one example. Someone has an affected parent. It's just, you know, it's a progressive neurodegenerative disorder that at this point has no treatment, although some medications may help improve the symptoms. So, you know, I have actually reviewed cases where they're trying to test a child for it. It's not always an adult onset disorder because there is something called anticipation. And if the number of repeats, the abnormal number of repeats increases in a child, which can happen, this can expand. There can be childhood onset, but it's always like a fine line. It's an adult onset disorder. Unless childhood onset is suspected, nobody below the age of 18 should be tested for it. And even at the age of 18 and above, we do extensive counseling. We generally don't test at the first visit, you know, because people, we end up giving them a lot to think about. Say it's untreatable at this point. How would this affect you? How would this affect, you know, your life decisions? Would this affect your insurance decisions? Because the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act does not protect does not protect what's called, what's termed luxury insurances, like long-term care, disability insurance, life insurance, et cetera. It affects health and employment. It affects health insurance and employment. So that's like, that's a huge hole. And, you know, you can't, it's definitely a lot of counseling, and, you know, it generally doesn't happen that someone comes in because they have a family history of Huntington's and gets tested that day. They usually come back. That's how we recommend it. So that's why, a child shouldn't be tested unless they're suspected to actually have early onset symptoms. And that's like, I've actually denied tests because I felt like there wasn't enough evidence. You know, you're treating a behavioral disorder in the child, like evidence that they might have, you know, early onset Huntington's. And then there's this. So sometimes there needs to be a lot of thought into whether genetic testing is done, mm-hmm. even if it's like a clear answer and it's not a question of too much knowledge, because some people do need to know, but, they'll make decisions based on that, but it's certainly, they need to have certain things in place, or at least think about whether they want this knowledge. So that's one area, the neurodegenerative disorders and other disorders like that, some cardiac disorders that tend to progress over time. And then there's hereditary cancer disorders that are adult onset. Not all of them are adult onset, but disorders like BRCA, I've had to deny tests that were ordered for teenage girls.
Mm-hmm. That's come up for me as a pediatrician.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's just, it's the child has a right to not know.
Right.
The individual should be able to make an informed choice, and the threshold for that is considered, you know, for a competent young adult is 18.
Right. And what are you going to do before 18 if you find that you have these genes?
Right. Just, you know, sort of, you know, become depressed, you know.
Right.
You know, yeah.
The risk outweighs the benefit.
Yeah.
Right. So you gave us so much information. This has been really, really amazing. And I want to thank you for doing this with me. And I want to encourage, you know, anybody who's in this process, you know, I can speak, you know, not just as a pediatrician, but as a parent, to be patient. I hope that people hear by listening to us talk how much change has happened, and in Mirz Hashem, how much change will happen in the future, that maybe even these disorders like Huntington's will have a cure. Right?
Yeah. I mean, gene therapy is, you know, just, you know, looking into what's, you know, Einstein said, you know, you can either approach life like believing there are no miracles or everything is a miracle. Gene therapy is a miracle,
right.
And it's a miracle in our time. And just the variety of disorders that's becoming treatable with gene therapy, you know, whether it's cystic fibrosis, you know, where it's really going to become life-saving, spinal muscular atrophy,
mm-hmm.
Whether it's, you know, having almost like a substitute enzyme for PKU where kids can now eat, you know, more protein in their diet, to whether it's, medications like Luxturna, which are gene therapy for degenerative retinal disorders that lead to blindness. And a new, there's actually a new treatment coming down the line that uses CRISPR technology to treat, a degenerative eye disease. There are miracles. Things are really changing fast. And, you know, just being in this field for 12 years, I just can't believe how much progress has been made.
It's incredible, and there should only be more. Thank you so much for doing this with me.
No problem.
Have a good Shabbos.
You too. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the JOMA Preventative Health Podcast. If you've enjoyed this, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and share this with your friends. For more information, check out our Instagram at JOMA_org. Check out our website, www.joma.org, that's JOMA.org, or email us at health@joma.org.